Chapter 63. The Hypocrisy of Allied Intervention. Lenin had heaped enough scorn and contempt on his suitors from Western Europe to provoke an unusual reaction from Lloyd George, who on April 16, 1919 declared in the House of Commons, "If, now that the Russian people have served our destiny by running so many risks, we tell them, 'Thank you, we are much obliged to you, you have been very useful, but now we no longer need you and the Bolsheviks can cut your throats,' we would be nothing but cowards, abominable cowards." Since Lloyd George's admonition had nudged their collective conscience, the Allies agreed to come, one might have believed at the time, to the help of the unfortunate Russian people. The British sent a division to Baku, Russia's oil capital, where 38 communist commissars were summarily put to death. The press always promoted the idea that the Nazis had been the first to initiate the practice of shooting Soviet commissars in Byelorussia during the summer of 1941. In fact, it was the British who practiced firing squad politics long before the Germans. It was also the British establishment which invented concentration camps in South Africa, where thousands of Boer women and children died of disease and starvation in atrocious conditions, a whole half-century before Dachau or Auschwitz were ever heard of. British interest in Baku and South Africa had the same motive: to protect the Rothschilds' exploitation of oil, gold and diamonds. During the 19th century, the Rothschilds had the British government undertake numerous imperialistic forays to further their own interests. The Boer Wars were a prime example. So was the British occupation between 1915 and 1918 of the Euphrates-Tigris region, Persia, the Arabian Gulf and the Hejaz of Arabia, which, along with Baku, would monopolize the world's oil industry in Rothschild hands. To secure the monopoly, British troops were sent during the winter of 1918 to seize the railroads and pipelines linking the Black and Caspian Seas in southern Russia, while the British Navy was controlling the coastlines. However, apart from the execution of 38 commissars, the British did not use their troops to stop the communists from slaughtering the Russians. The British were in Baku strictly to protect Rothschild oil wells, not mere people. The British establishment had, as usual, inveigled the French politicians into their Russian occupation scheme. Clemenceau was invited to sign, in the utmost secrecy, a convention whereby the British would cut the French in on some of southern Russia's choicest real estate. On December 23, 1917, 2 months after Lenin's coup, the secret treaty was signed by Clemenceau, and the British, French divisions would be sent to occupy Ukraine, in exchange for which Clemenceau would receive concessions in Bessarabia and the Crimea as well as in Ukraine, an area larger than France itself. The British establishment had conceived this munificent scheme in order to divert attention from their own monopolization of petroleum in the Caucasus and the Persian Gulf. French politicians took the bait and dreamed of a Thousand and One Nights empire falling into their lap courtesy of their friendly British ally. French divisions were rushed to Odessa to the strains of the Marseillaise and soon started on their march to Ukraine. The British had also talked the Greek leader Venizelos into joining the French expedition with two additional divisions by flatteringly comparing him to Alexander the Great. From the start, the hastily arranged expedition degenerated from the bizarre to the grotesque. The Ukrainian population stared in disbelief at these unfamiliar soldiers. They had accepted the presence of Germans because Germans had been an integral part of Russian and Ukrainian history for centuries. Millions of Germans had settled and prospered among them, but they had never seen a Frenchman. Their amazement quickly turned to anger, and they realized that many of their new saviors were not only not saving them from the communists, but were in fact forging links with the commissars. Communist propaganda, so seductive to the heirs of the French Revolution, had finally infected the French army. No sooner did the expedition arrive in Kiev than communist sympathizers and agitators among the troops organized enough subversion and sabotage to force a hasty retreat. Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, was abandoned to the Soviets. Then came the shocking news that the French Navy in the Black Sea had mutinied. The date was April 1919. The French government was stunned. The mutineers were jailed, including the ringleader, Marty, but, thanks to a left-wing press campaign, were soon released. Marty capitalized on his newly found success, the scandal. He became the darling of the Paris salons and got himself elected to the French Assembly. Marty's election was the sole result of France's expedition in Russia, apart from raising false hopes among millions of Russian and Ukrainian allies. In fact, the Bolsheviks used the French incursion as a pretext to engage in wholesale massacres of alleged collaborationists. Within 4 months, southern Russia had fallen to Lenin. The Allies still had two Russian fronts left: Murmansk, occupied by the British, and eastern Siberia, occupied by the Japanese and Americans. The British pretext for being in Murmansk was to stop the Germans, although no Germans ever appeared anywhere near there. The same pretext was used for the Japanese and American presence. This last Allied occupation was complicated by the unexpected appearance in Siberia of 50,000 Czechs, called Bohemians in those days. The Czechs were former prisoners of war from Austria-Hungary who had been released after the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution. Lenin had indoctrinated them and organized them into a separatist army destined to take power in Bohemia. It was Lenin's policy to recruit and train communist shock troops, then send them back to their respective countries to impose communism. The Allies and the communists made an agreement to repatriate the rearmed Czechs from the Siberian camps and throw them into battle against the Germans on the Western Front. They were loaded onto the Trans-Siberian railways with arms and supplies. During the long journey, the Czechs became unruly and started fighting and looting. At Irkutsk, the Soviets tried to disarm them, resulting in a full-scale mutiny. The Czechs had now turned against their Soviet mentors and were acting as something akin to freebooters. By now they were only interested in reaching the Pacific coast and boarding ships to abandon the war, the Germans, the Allies, the communists, and the anti-communists. Their feelings were shared by the American soldiers who had been sent to the Siberian wastelands on a nebulous expedition to save the Russians and fight the Germans. The two surviving divisions had been totally inactive and had no idea what they were doing in their frozen surroundings. The Japanese were busy fulfilling their objectives, which never included rescuing white Russians from the clutches of communism. The anti-communist Russians contemplated their saviors with a sinking heart. It was in these desperate straits that there emerged a purely Russian phenomenon, Admiral Kolchak. Admiral Kolchak was an intelligent and courageous naval officer who happened to be in Japan during Lenin's coup of 1917. Kolchak wasted no time in organizing the anti-communist Russian spread throughout the vast territory of eastern Russia. Within a few months, Kolchak had managed to recruit more than 100,000 Russian volunteers across Siberia. His plan was to retake all the territory between himself and Moscow and link up with the 13,000 British troops in Murmansk and Arkhangel. There were also some 40,000 Russian nationalists who had regrouped in northern Russia and had formed the Government of Northern Russia. If Kolchak succeeded in joining his compatriots and the British, he could relatively easily drive the Bolsheviks out of Moscow and put an end to Lenin's dictatorship once and for all. Churchill was the only advocate among the Allies of a genuine intervention to save the Russians from communism. Although the Allies had more than 12 million soldiers at their disposal, they would only need to send two or three divisions more to ensure Lenin's downfall. Churchill estimated 20 or 30,000 resolute men could, without great difficulty or casualties, push rapidly toward Moscow, sweeping all resistance before them. World Crisis, page 236. Meanwhile, Kolchak was advancing from the east, his anti-communist army growing in numbers every day. He was sure of Allied backing, which was promised to him in writing. In order to obtain Allied support, Kolchak had to agree to stringent conditions, which were almost laughable at such a time. While Russia was being ravaged, more than 8 million people had died during the first 18 months of Lenin's tyranny. The Allies had demanded that Kolchak act from the first day of his campaign of liberation as a Western-style politician with all the democratic trimmings. Kolchak will be required to convene a constituent assembly, democratically elected. What the Allies had never expected the communists to do, they demanded from the nationalists, who were fighting for their lives. After 2 years of communist atrocities, Russia needed peace and order more than liberal politicking. Yet Articles 1 and 2 of the agreement required that Kolchak issue the Bolsheviks with ballot papers. Article 5 obliged Kolchak to recognize the independence of the Caucasian and Transcaucasian territories, which the British had penetrated after the armistice of November 11, 1918 in order to acquire Russian oil. Article 8 was particularly sordid. It compelled Kolchak to commit himself to repay tens of billions of dollars borrowed by Imperial Russia, which Lenin had cancelled in 1917. The article took no account of Russia's desperate economic plight or the fact that Jewish revolutionaries had emptied the Russian treasury and they took over and had spirited its contents to Jewish banks in the West, where it remains to this day. The Allies wanted oil and money as the price for helping desperate people. Kolchak accepted these mercenary conditions because he knew his reconquest of Russia would otherwise be impossible. After months of painful negotiations, the agreement was signed by the Allies on June 12, 1919, just 2 weeks before the proclamation of the Versailles Treaty. Churchill deplored the lateness of the agreement. If this major and public decision was wise in June, how much more it would have been in January. The declaration of the agreement came too late. World Crisis, page 183. The Allied declaration was in any case a piece of treachery. They had no intention of using their own troops to fight the Bolsheviks. If Kolchak seemed to be winning, he would be supplied with army surplus and second-hand arms, but this would be the limit. The Russian admiral, however, was led to believe at all times that the Allies would join him in battle. The Allies' double-dealing was illustrated in a document outlining their plan of action, issued by the Allied Supreme Council on May 26, 1919, their only aim will be to assist Russian elements seeking to pursue the struggle against German autocracy and the liberation of their own country. The struggle against German autocracy was sheer nonsense, considering that the war with Germany was over and that the Murmansk region had never had, even during the war years, to deal with such an autocracy. Since 1917, only Soviet troops had been stationed on the shores of the Arctic Ocean. And the British appealed to Kolchak in June 1919 to attack them. The British had promised to fight on the side of the Russian nationalists as the main incentive for Kolchak to start combat. The Allies would send some 300,000 obsolete rifles, leftovers from the war, for which they had no further use, but were determined to stay out of the fighting. Churchill understated the position when he wrote, "The decision to support Kolchak was taken half-heartedly. Allied hypocrisy and vacillation was matched by Lenin's rage. He swore, 'From now on there will no longer be a world war, there will be a universal war.'" Lord Curzon in his memoirs deplored the Allies' craven response, "Our policy is incoherent. It is in fact non-existent. The Allies have dithered between gratitude and courteous indifference to the nationalist Russians. This policy has been shifting and uncertain. We can expect serious trouble or worse." On July 29, 1919, Churchill reminded the House of Commons, "We are bound by solemn commitments to the Russians, who have been our allies as well as the populations we have encouraged, in resisting communism. The tradition of our country had always been to pay particular attention to this type of thing." Churchill, of course, discounted the institutionalized hypocrisy of the British establishment with its built-in policy of welching on agreements. Kolchak was unaware of the Allies' deviousness and was fighting his way to meet the British at Murmansk. In the middle of the campaign, Kolchak was informed that the British were preparing to leave Murmansk before winter. Britain was having an election and politicians who had whipped up war hysteria for 4 years were now running on a peace platform, casualties had hit home, and the voters were sick of war. The news did little for the morale of the Russians' patriots, but they continued their fight. After retreating to Perm, Kolchak nevertheless once again took the offensive and breached the Soviet lines to a depth of 150 miles. Perhaps the Allies would be impressed by Russian bravery.